This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Iraq's parliament is taking a recess for the month of August. Key pieces of legislation, such as the U.S.-backed oil distribution law, have been set aside until lawmakers return on the 4th of September. Against the backdrop of Iraq's struggling democracy, the daily news there is daunting. There's the ongoing sectarian violence, the mounting civilian and military casualties, and the United States is increasingly concerned about neighboring countries contributing to Iraq's instability. It's enough to make even the best informed citizens here and abroad numbed and weary of the news. Ellen Lapson says she can understand that numbing effect, and she's an Iraq scholar who has focused on that part of the world for years. In a recent speech at the Chautauqua Institution, Lapson looked back at what steps and missteps were made, what the situation is on the ground now, and what paths might be taken for governing in Iraq in the future. Her more thorough assessment of Iraq is the speech that we'll hear today on Word for Word. Lapson is the president and CEO of the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington, D.C., and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She was director for Near East and South Asian Affairs for the National Security Council in the mid-90s and later served as the vice chair of the National Intelligence Council. And here she is, speaking in late July at the Chautauqua Institution in New York, Iraq scholar Ellen Lapson.
Let's get started on the discussion of can we better understand what's actually going on in Iraq. I have met with a lot of Iraqis, and I've had a couple of projects over the past years that have been bringing people from Iraqi civil society out, journalists and social scientists and people who run think tanks in Iraq. And I also visited northern Iraq in May, so I try to talk to Iraqis who are not necessarily the politicians in Baghdad. And I am deeply aware of how hard it is for any of us to really have a three-dimensional view of what's going on in this society that we have now temporarily taken occupation of. And I realize that the media are doing the best they can. They live in a war zone. They are limited by their own bosses from traveling very far in the country. We rely a lot on very young Iraqis to bring information to the Western news services so it can be reported to us on our television screens and in our newspapers. But I also realize the media is driven by new news events. So they are looking at 24-hour bang-bang stories, if you will. And there's, you know, the lead is always how many car bombs went off, to the point where at least I feel that I am numb in trying to assess what does one more car bomb mean. When I see that there's a day where 50 people died, is that different than a day when 80 people died or 30 people died? I have no capacity to calibrate anymore, just reading the endless string of stories of violence. And there has to be some other realities going on in Iraq that we also want to try to understand. So we get the macro story of what is going on in Iraq that meets the news threshold. We're not getting the totality of how do educated, nonviolent Iraqis cope, how do they think about the future, and how what life choices are they making under these horrible, horrible conditions in which they live. And here it is worth mentioning that Baghdad is a third of the country in terms of population, but it is the most dangerous place of Iraq. And there are medium-sized towns and cities in Iraq where people eat in outdoor restaurants and movie theaters are full and people go about their daily lives. It's very hard to keep that in our minds as we think about Iraq. We think of just relentless and comprehensive violence, and that's probably not a correct understanding of what the majority of Iraqis experience on a day-to-day basis. We also need to understand that an important subset of Iraqi society are deeply, deeply committed to trying to build a new Iraq. There is enthusiasm and excitement in pockets of Iraqi society for the opportunity they've been given. I have met with many Iraqis who do say, look, our lives are frightening, but we are still grateful. Sooner or later, we needed to come to the post-Saddam period. You gave us that opportunity. Now we just are desperate to not misuse the opportunity. And they are frightened themselves by the violence that has broken out in their society and don't know whether they will make it. You talk to young, educated Iraqis who say, you know, I came back from London, I want to be part of this exciting experience, but I don't know how long I can last. Endless stories of people coming back, sending their children abroad, and not knowing how long they can hold out. But it is my opinion that slowly but surely, Iraqis care about these new political institutions. They don't necessarily like the politicians. Does that sound familiar? But they still believe in their institutions. They still believe that having a constitution is a good thing, that having elections is a good thing. And so I think we sometimes are ignorant of the level to which Iraqis take some quiet pride in the fact that the political architecture of their country has changed and that they want to be part of it. It's hard to go out. It's hard to go to the grocery store. Every judgment about leaving your home, particularly if you live in Baghdad, is fraught with risk management. Every day, Iraqis have to think about, do I go right at this corner or should I take the long way around? You know, where might I run into trouble? They're constantly doing risk management, but they do want to participate. And they do, I think, have some pride that they have new institutions. It is indisputably true that the center of the new Iraqi political system is weak. And it's weak for a number of reasons. It's weak in partly because we and the United Nations supported an electoral system that emphasized diversity over effectiveness, if you will. We went for as close to true democracy right from the get-go instead of something that would have been a more representative system for a transition period. So there is, in the political mix now, people who have never before participated in politics of any kind. And I see one of the sources of tension in Iraq's, in the failure of the central government of Iraq to get its act together, is the fact that you have people of, basically the Shia underclass of Iraq has now been empowered. They have never done politics before, and it is rough. It is rough around the edges, and they are feisty, and they are emotional, and they are not yet imbued with any of the behavior of a more mature democracy where you listen to your adversary, you express respect for that person's opinion, even while you insist that your own view is different. I think that a significant portion of the Iraqi parliament hasn't learned that yet. And so we do see a winner-take-all, a zero-sum approach to politics. There are other parts of the Iraqi political system that are highly educated and secular and have been waiting for decades to get to participate in democracy. And so you have cultural clashes even within the Iraqi political system now. You have people who are at different stages of education of what it is to be in a democratic system. And as hard as it is to say, I think we should understand that this takes time. This is not an overnight proposition. It is also true that the country does have a Shia majority, but simply saying that doesn't really explain anything, because within the Shia majority of Iraq are people of very, very diverse background and very diverse political preferences. I see in Iraq not just the sectarian divisions, but also social divisions. There are deep divisions between secular people and traditional religious people. There are deep divisions between urban and rural. So the societal friction that we're seeing should not be explained away under this very one-dimensional label of everybody's either a Sunni or a Shia, and that's why they're mad at each other. I think it's even more, it's playing out on different levels. And we're certainly seeing, in a very interesting way, a new inter-Shia political debate and contestation. Not all the Shia political parties are against the American occupation. The faction that is led by this young man, Muqtada al-Sadr, who's from one of the most prominent clerical families in Iraq, is passionately against the American occupation. And so Shia voters have to decide between these political parties of very, very different policies. Some people are talking about soft partition as a way of managing the societal tensions and violence that is in Iraq today. And they think that allowing Iraq to simply split into three parts, with Kurds in the north, the western part of the country controlled by Sunni tribes and political leaders, and then the Baghdad and the south under Shia political domination, would be a solution. Right now, the people who are advocating this idea, I would say, are doing it largely for humanitarian reasons. They're very profoundly affected by concerns about ethnic cleansing and about sort of the forced migration of Iraqis even inside Iraq. And they think that soft partition is perhaps the least bad option for the international community. And this idea includes use of the American military to literally define safe zones where we would be sort of facilitating the movement of people inside Iraq so that you could live in a homogeneous zone with people who are of the same sect as you. I am not philosophically or politically ready to embrace this idea. It may be that it happens out of dreadful circumstances, out of a civil war whose dimensions we have not yet seen. But I still think that American policy, since we returned sovereignty to Iraq and since we are trying to somehow separate perhaps American interests from Iraqi interests, that we have to be very, very careful about how much we try to social engineer Iraqi society. We have proven that we don't understand it well enough, and I think that we should avoid trying to make these existential choices for the Iraqis themselves. There's also, I think, an illusion that breaking up Iraq, whether it's a soft partition, meaning the international boundaries of Iraq stay the same, or a true breakup, which might include what happened in Yugoslavia, where slowly but surely the international community lets each of the parts have their own flag and their own seat at the UN. There's an illusion that somehow this will prevent the regional spillover that everybody's afraid of. Everybody's afraid that the Iraq problem will get bigger, that it will become territorially even beyond Iraq's borders, and that we'll be seeing just more violence spreading. I think it's an illusion to believe that partition, either soft partition or breakup, would somehow calm the waters regionally. I think it would have the opposite effect. It would clarify to the predators, the would-be predators, that they can, in fact, be the outside patron of one part of Iraq or another. And I think that it would actually accelerate and stimulate meddling by the neighbors. So I am still of the view that we have to do what we can to preserve Iraq as a functioning state, as a unitary state if possible, possibly with very strong federalism or other forms of decentralization, but that I don't see all the advantages of partition that some others have seen. And lastly, I think we should just spend a minute or two on this emerging crisis of Iraqi refugees. And I think that in my own view, I'm deeply worried that we can't yet anticipate that the out-migration of 2 million of 10% or more of the total Iraqi population to neighboring countries could have the generational impact that the migration of Palestinians has had. The Palestinians who became refugees after the 48 war, after 67, have clearly shaped the politics of the Middle East for 50 years or more. And I think that if we look at the demographics of the Iraqi refugees, we see the potential for it to have some of the same dimensions. Some of the Iraqis who are leaving are the very best and brightest of Iraq. They are the educated professional class. In the short run, this may be good for some of the neighboring countries. And in small Gulf countries, for example, people are pleased that the quality of faculty members of the local university has gone up because there are Iraqi teachers available. Hospitals in Jordan are staffed with Iraqi doctors. Those that are not in London already filling the hospitals. But you have, and so that there is a dispersion, if you will, of an educated class of professionals that has some short-term economic and social benefit to the receiving countries. But in addition, some of the people who are leaving Iraq are very poor and very frightened people. These are people who are frightened and have this new anxiety about their sectarian identity. And in almost any country in which they can find temporary refuge, they can become a political force that could be a disruptive force. We are seeing already that refugees in Jordan are heightening the consciousness in Jordan of Sunni-Shia divisions. Divisions, you know, cultural differences that had been not seen as particularly important. People would know in a society, these folks are Sunni, these folks are Shi'i, but it was not a source of turbulence. Now, with the movement of Iraqi refugees to some of the neighboring countries, it is a source of turbulence, and you are seeing governments and security forces and police suddenly learning to distinguish between people of different sects and treating them differently. So what we're seeing is the danger that the refugees themselves become a vector of sectarianism in the countries in which they're located. And I would say that for those Iraqis that are clever enough to try to apply for asylum in Western countries, the West has not even begun to begin to do the work to decide how many Iraqis we can process and absorb. I think the United States, for perhaps obvious political reasons, has been extremely slow to acknowledge that there are Iraqi asylum seekers, and we have given only a few thousand visas to Iraqis, and that only recently. And I think we could be facing a situation where we will be allowing to come in under special status possibly tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of Iraqis if our engagement there collapses in some calamitous way, which I hope it will not. But we are seeing Iraq change as a society. It is changing because Christians are leaving, it is changing because Sunnis are leaving, and it's changing because some of the most educated part of the population are leaving. So that what is left is a society where the balance is shifting in favor of the people that Muqtada al-Sadr represents. It is possible that we are going to see an Iraq that has a very populist, radical Shia agenda, and that will be mainstream politics in Iraq, and that everybody else has to kind of accept their minority status. This is a very different Iraq than the one we thought we were helping to create, and it will, I believe, involve some enduring challenges and dilemmas for both the United States and for the region.
Ellen Lapson speaking July 26th at the Chautauqua Institution in New York State. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Let me just bring in here, as we talk about changing demographics and changing society, one kind of historic reference point. We, and I would include myself and other folks who watch Iraq, in some cases understood when the debate over going into Iraq in 2002 began, understood that there were soft points in our data or our understanding of what is Iraqi society really like now, what's the rate of literacy, what's the distribution of communities. We knew that our data was soft, but we very much undervalued what the impact of both the decade-long Iran-Iraq War, which was the decade of the 1980s, and the decade of sanctions, UN and U.S. sanctions against Iraq, which is the story of the 1990s, that 20-year period really led to an erosion of the middle class in Iraq and led to some sort of deep societal shifts that we were only superficially aware of. So we did not understand how much the middle class had either left or was no longer middle class. And middle class, as the political scientists understand it, is one of the key ingredients of creating stable democratic systems, that the middle class have economic interests, they are educated enough to petition their government, and that they are the engine that keeps functioning democracies going. And we had assumed that Iraq enjoyed a more robust middle class as compared to many Middle Eastern countries, and we were painfully, I would say, unaware of how much that middle class had been hollowed out and had atrophied as a result of these two decades of Saddam's rule, where a lot of bad things happened to Iraq and its economy. So we just have to add that piece to my discussion of Iraq post-2003 to understand that this is a different society, and the choices that Iraqis may make will not necessarily be ones that we would have wanted them to make, but that's where we are. Let's turn to a possible next story. What's the next chapter in this very sad saga? What might Iraq look like over the next few years? And the first point I think we should all make is that neither we can know, and the Iraqis themselves don't know. Nobody has the secret narrative of what will Iraq's future look like, and just hasn't managed to share it with us. It is, to borrow the infamous Donald Rumsfeld's phrase, it's one of the unknowables. And but we do look at, we as good analysts should be thinking about what we understand of today's dynamics and how they might play out, and what are the factors that will affect Iraq's future. I mean, just to jump to the chase, I think that we could imagine at least three plausible outcomes that would play out over the next 3 to 5 years. And I'm not trying to do a 12-month projection. Let's say 3 to 5 years. One would be that things get worse, that the surge is understood to have failed, that the Iraqi security services basically don't develop that critical mass of national loyalty. They essentially see themselves as serving their communities or their geographic regions of Iraq. And so that all this investment in the national forces, the police and the army of Iraq, will turn out to be not much more than validating a sectarian militia system. And I do think that is a scenario for Iraq, that the coercive power that we all understand has to be a monopoly of the state. In Iraq, that coercive power has already been distributed across subgroups, and that may be the future of Iraq for a while. This scenario would involve a continuing weakness of the center, so that the national government plods along but doesn't quite get enough done to make a difference in the daily lives of Iraqis. And in this chaos scenario, this isn't chaos, this is really a diffusion of power and a sustained high level of violence, and possibly, and this is folded in with civil war, if you will. A second plausible scenario would be that the Shia government, the majority government of Iraq, just show less and less interest in the other groups. They don't try as hard to make accommodations for the Sunni minority. They let the Kurds govern themselves up in the north. And what you see is a creeping sort of, that there's no longer a pretense of shared pluralist democracy in Iraq, but what you have is Shia domination. And under that scenario, even if you had managed levels of violence, you would see an outmigration of Sunnis, and you would make more likely the possibility that the Kurds would declare independence. And a third scenario would be that, possibly in cahoots with the neighbors and possibly in cahoots with Western powers, we would see the reemergence of a secular strongman in Iraq. And I think it's not unreasonable for people to say, gee, wouldn't it be nice if there were a secular general that had the capacity to kind of impose law and order, let people go back to their normal lives, let the economy kind of stabilize, give people much greater personal freedom, more human rights than happened under Saddam, but that you would have a strong state that had control of the territory of the country and was able to prevent use of Iraqi soil by terrorists or by angry militia and sectarian groups. I think that's a scenario that some people may like compared to the others, but it's hard to imagine how it is engineered. If you accept my premise that Iraqis actually do care that they have a constitution and that they now have a government that's in power until late 2009. A less likely scenario is, but if we're patient enough, we might get there, that sometime at the 5 to 10 year mark, we might see in Iraq that is slowly stabilizing, and it is a multicultural Iraq. And I think one of the poignant parts of this whole experience has been that we've discovered that Iraq is an important bridge country between more homogeneous Arab countries and Iran. Iran is, after all, a great civilization and a great power. It's a country that is 3 times the size of Iraq, and it is one of the natural leaders of the region. And Iraq, with a Q at the end, has the capacity to be a very important transition country, managing Arab-Iran relations and representing a kind of multiculturalism that some other Arab countries don't have. That does require that the Sunnis feel that it's their country too, that the Kurds don't declare independence in the north, and that the other Arab countries accept Iraq's exceptionalism. They have to believe that a strong and pluralist Iraq is the 21st century, that we are past the period of the late 20th century when the norm for Arab states was to have a military strongman. So I still hold out some small hope that over time Iraq will get there, but I fear that these other scenarios would make it even less likely that Iraq could have that more stable and promising future. A lot of people like to focus on the role of the regional actors, and I am one who believes that we mustn't exaggerate the capacity of the neighbors to give enough attention to Iraq or to come up with a coherent and constructive policy to Iraq that would make all the difference. I think the neighbors are all countries that have their own domestic preoccupations, and most of them, their instinct is to keep Iraq's problems away from them, not to engage them more. I also think that we have a kind of confusing discourse towards the neighbors, where on the one hand we say, don't meddle, but in the next breath we say, please get more involved. And please get more involved means forgive their debt, write big checks, support the government, do nice political, cultural, and economic things, but don't meddle. Don't meddle on the security side in particular. And I'm not sure all the neighbors understand our message of don't meddle, but get involved. But again, my point would be that the neighbors, I don't believe, will be the determinants of Iraq's future. I think that Iraq is a big country with its own history, with its own... this is not a very small country that can be swallowed up by its neighbors. It is a real space that has historical integrity and legitimacy, and I think that Iraq now owns its future. The neighbors don't own Iraq's future. If Iraq were to there is still predatory behavior, and here Iran, of course, is the biggest problem. Iran is the country that has the most capacity to influence Iraq, and it has the most ambition to do so. Turkey and the Arabs care, but they care in a defensive way, I think. Iran cares in an offensive way. Iran wants to be there. It has offices in every Iraqi town and village. People can, you know, in front of their friends and neighbors, walk into an Iranian intelligence shop and get a check and come out and be an agent for the Iranian government. The Iranians are funding schools, they're building hospitals, they're providing electricity. They have normal business interaction. They have this very important tie of the pilgrimages to the pilgrims to the Shia holy sites, and they also have all this subversive activity. They're paying clearly for the ability of some of the bad guys to get the weapons they need, and I don't think that's much in dispute. So Iran has this very robust and multifaceted engagement in Iraq, and the rest of Iraq's neighbors do not. So this is, of course, yet another one of the complications and problems of Iraq. There's a new consideration of whether the UN should be part of a more important player in Iraq's future. And I believe that the beginning of this discussion, Zal Khalilzad, who's recently moved from being ambassador to Iraq to the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Khalilzad is now promoting a greater role for the UN and almost conceding that the United States maybe needs to hand off particularly the political tasks to the United Nations. It is true that in 2004 we did ask the UN, and the UN performed this function. The UN was deeply involved in the organization of the elections that led to constitution and national elections in Iraq, and that is an area of core competence of the UN system. But for the UN, these are very hard choices. The UN to come in where the protection to the UN staff is provided by an occupying foreign country is quite untenable. That is not politically appropriate for the UN, even though it's essentially the only way it could be done. The UN is certainly not in a position to replace the United States on the security side, and so there would have to be some awkwardly negotiated partnership between the United States and the United Nations. But my basic question is, do the Iraqis want it? Would this be helpful to them? I'm not sure that the current politically active people in Iraq have such favorable views to the United Nations. They do associate the United Nations with those years of sanctions and with the economic degradation of Iraq that was mostly Saddam's fault, but also exacerbated by choices that the international community made. So I don't see an easy scenario where Iraq can have one important outside partner that will help bring about stability. But I would say, not to be to give the wrong impression, I think the UN is a player in Iraq. The UN is involved in Iraqi reconstruction, in humanitarian needs, and the UN could, over time, become the preeminent political partner and even protector of Iraq. But to get there, we will have to go through an acknowledgement that we cannot do it. And I think that is something that might happen in 2009. I'm not sure it will happen this year or next. Let's turn for a last discussion to looking at all the bad options available to the United States, which ones are more bad and which ones are less bad, if I can abandon my English grammar there for a minute. I think we all have to be careful as citizens to try to think through the political rhetoric, which says, you know, most of the candidates line up and saying, let's get out now, and a president who says, got to do the honorable thing, you know, success is around the corner. That binary proposition, that as if the choice were stay or go, versus the reality on the ground. I said at the beginning, we are engaged in Iraq. It's not that easy to get out. We can all agree, and opinion polls suggest, that the overwhelming majority of Americans think that we haven't succeeded and we cannot succeed, and therefore the right thing to do is to scale back our engagement. I strongly endorse all of that logic chain. But to say it can happen now or it can happen tomorrow isn't the reality that I know. I think that getting out of Iraq is a process. It has to be managed, and it will take probably several years. And I don't imagine a scenario in which we get out entirely, unless the Iraqis kick us out. It is possible that the Iraqis will tell us to leave everything. We don't want we don't want an embassy. We don't want guns for hire security forces. We don't want your soldiers. Go home. That is possible. I don't think it's the most likely scenario. I think that Iraqis want us to stay for now. But I think that the process of leaving is going to be a hard one for the politicians. Whoever gets to the White House next is going to have to be careful of how much the campaign rhetoric and the responsibility of being president, to make sure that the gap isn't too huge between those two things, of things they say during the campaign and the inevitable reality of getting to the White House in 2009 and Iraq is still item number one on your desk. You can't wish it away. So I do think that we're managing a process of disengaging where we still haven't made we haven't begun to reflect on what's the residual presence, what's the mission. Can we still have soldiers in Iraq that will be training Iraqis and will be fighting al-Qaeda but not doing neighborhood watches in dangerous streets of Baghdad, and I think that's what most members of Congress now think is where we need to go. But I also worry about disengaging from Iraq in terms of what it does for our own self-respect, our own understanding of American power in the world, and our own society. I do think we have to worry, but let me just circle back for a minute. The residual American presence in Iraq, one of the almost comical things that has happened in the last couple of years is that we have built the largest American embassy in the world in Iraq. We have built a compound that is several times larger than the UN headquarters in New York. We have spent almost $1 billion on a compound that has 24 buildings in it, and that some of those buildings are just to house the Marines that will protect the thousand of civilians that serve the United States policy. This will become, I am almost certain, a monument to American folly. And where is Barbara Tuchman when we need her? This embassy is a symbol of a grandiose ambition and a hubris on the part of our government that I think will be, in the end, it will be an embarrassment. I've already asked Iraqis, could you imagine it as a campus of a new Iraqi university, or you know, what would we do with these buildings? So we have created the expectation that our presence is huge for some foreseeable period of time. I think that is not likely. I think that we do need a scaled back civilian presence as well as military presence. But I think that Iraq is an important country in the region, and I think we will continue to have interest there, even if the government is not our client, even if it's a feisty, independent state that is not necessarily pro-American. So there are lots of policy choices that have to be made about commitment to resources, what's the right number of people that should be in Iraq for this scaled-back mission. We haven't talked yet about the reconciliation process, and I just wanted to end with a couple of thoughts on reconciliation, because I think that suits the themes of things that you all think about while you're here at Chautauqua. So I guess I'm ending with a note that we will need at some point a reconciliation of Americans and Iraqis, of Americans who've served in Iraq with Americans who have not, and certainly see if we can do more to help the Iraqis reconcile with each other. When I was in Iraq in May, a Kurdish woman described being sent to South Africa in 2003 on an American-funded program. We've had many good ideas to help the Iraqis. They haven't all produced the results we had hoped. She was sent to South Africa to meet with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and learn of the South African experience of how much it could be helpful to Iraqis. And she came back very, very discouraged. She said, not only do we not have a Nelson Mandela, but we don't have a de Klerk. We don't have a Ba'athi authority figure who will say what we did was wrong, we apologize, and that she, as a Kurd, said, we cannot begin the process of forgiveness until someone from that old power system acknowledges that what they did was wrong. And this is where the execution of Saddam Hussein has turned out to be unhelpful, to be frank, that Saddam was executed on a timetable that was driven by the Shia's grievance towards him, that they got their satisfaction, that he was executed because of crimes against them. They had not yet finished the genocide trial on the Kurds, so the Kurds feel permanently deprived of the historical closure proving that Saddam had committed genocide against them and that that era was over. He went to his death never having been proven guilty of the crimes against the Kurds, and this deeply bothers them. They wanted justice to work for them as well as for the Shia, and I am worried that the societal reconciliation that our own government believes is somehow the same thing as, you know, the government learning how to pass an oil law, that those two processes happen in very different ways. One is really a bottom-up societal process, and the other one is a kind of governance leadership function. But that Iraq has not yet really shown that it has the energy or the mindset to begin that internal reconciliation process.
Iraq scholar Ellen Lapson speaking July 26th at the Chautauqua Institution. Lapson served as National Intelligence Officer for the Near East in the early 90s and was Vice Chair of the National Intelligence Council from 1997 until 2002. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. After giving her speech, Ellen Lapson fielded some questions from the audience.
You had mentioned Iran as the one neighboring country that you described as offensive and deeply involved. Can you talk a little bit about their motivations for being in Iraq?
I think, as everybody knows, Iran is an overwhelmingly majority Shia country, and it is a Persian civilization, but for many centuries now, it has also been the seat of the Shia sect within Islam, although Iraq actually enjoys, Iraq, not Iran, is also the seat of some of the most important shrines and centers of learning of Shia theology. So Iran and Iraq have a very deep bond through. In Iraq, the two places are Najaf and Karbala, and in Iran, it's Qom. These are the three great centers of Shia theology and learning. So there is a deep religious and cultural bond between the two countries. Iran also sees itself as a natural leader of the Arab world, and the longest border it enjoys, the only border it enjoys with an Arab country is Iraq. So Iran has sees Iraq as a gateway, if you will, or as the transitional country to its relations with the rest of the Arab world. Across the water, Iran relates to the smaller Arab countries of the Gulf, but Iraq is geographically strategic for Iran. I also think that when the emergence of three successive prime ministers in Iraq now that are from the Shia community, Iran believes it has a friendly government in Iraq. Iran and Iraq, as we all know, were enemies. The Iranians deeply loathed Saddam Hussein, and the feeling was mutual. And now there is a friendly government. The people who are politically active on the Shia side in Iraq today, many, many of them have deep ties to Iran from their own personal lives. They lived in Iran during periods of exile, etc. So the ties are pretty, they're personal, cultural, religious, and strategic. And let me throw in economic just for good mix, okay?
How realistic or unrealistic is it for the United States to shift its focus to a humanitarian one, rebuilding schools, businesses, roads, etc.? Is that possible?
I think that we were quite attentive to humanitarian needs in the lead-up to the war in 2003. Before the United States went in, a lot of work was done to pre-position and try to anticipate humanitarian needs. I mean, the great irony is that we were over-prepared for humanitarian crises that did not occur. There was not a collapse of, you know, at least initially, there were not internally displaced, there was not a health crisis, etc. Right from the beginning, there should have been more electricity, and there could have been things that could have created greater humanitarian need. But I think we were initially attentive and sensitive to humanitarian needs that, ironically, didn't materialize. We have all along had a program for the reconstruction of Iraq that included rebuilding their infrastructure, working with Iraqis to decide, you know, what roads need to be rebuilt, hospitals, and certainly where initially priority was given to repairing anything that we had damaged ourselves. So if in the act of war we had destroyed anything, our first obligation was to replace it and rebuild. But then in addition, over a more longer period of time, to work with the Iraqis on what their reconstruction plans and objectives were. The sad truth is that we aimed too high. We created contracting mechanisms that were on such a large scale and so complex that we didn't do the small, easy, low-hanging fruit stuff as well as we should have. And a little bit late in the game, but still in calendar year 2003, the military figured out how to give the local, you know, commander, it could be a lieutenant colonel who's in a town, walking around money, to just give the soldiers a few thousand dollars in their pocket to give someone to paint a school or to repair a bridge. And we should have started much more small-scale stuff, and I think it would have had more impact. Instead, we, you know, because it was, let's be honest, it was the Pentagon who does everything big, and they created a structure that was so grandiose and had so many American players in it that it didn't get to the Iraqis fast enough. So, but I think I would not accept the premise that we have not cared at all about humanitarian things. I think we've had a lot of activities going. They have not all produced the right results, and sometimes they've produced the results that they were intended to do, and then the bad guys come in and destroy it. So sometimes you succeed in rebuilding the school, you build the clinic, you train the new municipal council, and then key players get shot, or the pipeline gets sabotaged, or the school gets burned. So,
if, as you now believe, it was a mistake to invade Iraq, what could, should we have done about Saddam Hussein?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question, because knowing now what we know, maybe we didn't have to do anything. I mean, clearly Saddam's survival as a nasty dictator didn't fit in with our plans to help the Middle East, you know, enter the 21st century, get on the globalization train, learn about democracy, et cetera. He would have always been an outlier and a sore. But I think if the American people and the American Congress had understood that there really, not only was there not an imminent threat, but there wasn't even a strategic threat. There wasn't, he didn't have the capacity to do us as much harm. Maybe we could have lived with sanctions and containment. But to be honest, I think I may have mentioned, I worked on Iraq policy at the White House in the mid-90s, and we did have a sense that we were kind of living on borrowed time, that it was hard to sustain the level of energy to sanctions. We knew Saddam was cheating. We knew the sanctions regime was unraveling and eroding. So, you know, we all knew that it's sooner or later we were going to have to come up with some new tricks in our toolbox to keep Saddam from doing any more harm than he had already done. But I think in hindsight we now understand he was militarily contained. He was no longer a strategic threat. And while he was, and this is not something Iraqis like to hear, that Iraqis, you know, if the judgment is over to you, Iraqis, you don't like him, figure out a way to get rid of him. That was the reality that they had been living in for decades, and they were, at least, you know, many were very grateful that the United States had taken the risk to get rid of him. But, you know, certainly from a state interest perspective, we would not have had to do what we did.
Several questions about oil, its role in the decision to go into Iraq, the impact of the passage of an Iraq oil law, and just what the state of the oil production capacity in Iraq currently is.
Well, I wish our government had made clearer right from the beginning. I mean, we've said it publicly, but we, I guess, haven't said it loudly enough or frequently enough, that we didn't go in to steal Iraq's oil, okay? And I deeply believe that. I believe that oil was not the key determinant. Oil is one of the reasons why Iraq is an important country, that Iraq's contribution to the international system is in part based on the fact that it's an important oil producer. But I deeply believe the United States did not have any secret oil-related agenda in going into Iraq. We did believe we want Iraq to be a producer. We want them to be an exporter. We want them to benefit from the revenue that they get from their oil. But I think we could have said more clearly or more persuasively that, you know, Iraq's oil is its patrimony, its natural asset. We are frustrated that the Iraqis have not finished the oil laws, and it's a set of, I think, four pieces of legislation that, you know, reestablish the mandate for the Iraqi National Oil Company, set rules on the role of any foreign parties, whether they're governments or oil companies, in developing and exploiting Iraq's oil. But most important for the Iraqis is the distribution of the revenues of, is it, you know, and they've settled on a purely population ratio basis. There was early talk that the oil revenue had to be, that there were weighted factors so that the Shia and the Kurds would get more oil revenue to compensate them, that there would be like a victim's compensation fund, and that from the oil money you'd get this extra compensation. They've more or less bagged that, and it is oil being the revenue being distributed on a purely population ratio basis. But the Iraqis have, first of all, they have a very sophisticated technocratic class that knows how to do oil. I mean, they don't need us to tell them. They have geologists, they have petroleum engineers, they have oil economists. They know how to manage their oil sector. But they're having a big problem with sabotage of pipelines and infrastructure, and there are issues of security for the whole oil infrastructure. I think in the end the Iraqis will make compromises on oil because it's existential for them. It's the one thing that keeps them going, that allows the state to be hopefully a relatively strong state. But they, I think, are frustrated so far. And then one of the sort of amusing things is that Iraq and Iran actually swap oil because there's an uneven refinery capacity between the two countries. And the other thing they've got to get rid of is they heavily subsidize oil. So they have to wean citizens of almost free oil. Iran has the same problem, that a lot of the oil-rich countries almost give it away to their citizens. And as you open up your economy, what happened in Iraq in 2003 was that there was this surge in consumer consumption. In consumption, more people got cars. There was a kind of burst of economic activity. And the subsidizing oil, that at that moment, they needed to have adjusted the subsidy system, which they failed to do.
Ellen Lapson, former vice chair for the National Intelligence Council and the current head of the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. She spoke July 26th at the Chautauqua Institution in New York State. If you missed part of today's speech, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. There you can subscribe to our free weekly podcast in addition to listening to this show or any of our previous programs, including speeches by White House political advisor Karl Rove, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and Democratic Senator Jim Webb of Virginia. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.